Good morning, all. The first case for argument is the United States versus Cruz. Mr. Shelback.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Under the sentencing guidelines, a defendant's sentence can be enhanced for abuse of a private trust where the defendant occupied, in the language of the guidelines, professional or managerial discretion, and where the defendant is imbued with substantial discretionary judgment over various decisions, in this case of the company, PES, such that that person is found to abuse a private position of trust. In this case, the defendant, Carmen Cruz, had no discretionary authority of any kind and made no managerial discretionary judgments such that she warranted this enhancement. And in rereading the government's responsive brief just this morning, I tried to identify the conduct that the government claims warrants this enhancement. And running through their brief, what the government talked about was that Ms. Cruz oversaw the bookkeeping of the company. She paid bills, she wrote checks, she forged checks, she altered records by putting false payees in the book, and received mail, and in some instances, destroyed, canceled checks. Not one of those items of conduct called upon Ms. Cruz to make a judgment call about what should or shouldn't happen that led to this fraud in this case. She did not decide which bills should be paid and which bills should not be paid. She had no authority or no discretion to reduce a bill or to make a determination that certain bills should or should not be paid. She made no judgment calls about any decision other than engage in the ministerial act of writing the checks, and which the government concedes in this case, Ms. Cruz was not authorized to sign the checks. That had to be done by her boss, Kenneth Mason. And so as part of her routine duties, she would receive bills, would write out the portions of the checks other than the signature, and hand them to Mr. Mason, who would then sign them. In order to carry out her fraud, she forged a number of checks and caused bills to be paid, in this case her own private bills, as well as shared money that she embezzled with Mr. Mason's son, who was also an employee at the company.
Mr. Shelback, is there a meaningful factual distinction between Ms. Cruz and the controller in Deal?
Is there any meaningful?
The
controller in Deal, as I recall, had access to not only the checks, but had also the authority to sign checks, as I recall, and also was fairly unsupervised, although I think in Deal there was an indication that at some point what he did do was monitored by some accountant. It's very close to Deal, I would concede that, but it's also extremely close, In my view, substantially closer to the ordinary bank teller, which the guidelines expressly say should not receive this enhancement. Because an ordinary bank teller steals money, has access to the records, at least within her scope of entries that she puts in, makes false entries on many occasions, but is not imbued with any decision-making or any judgment calls, which in Tiohanco, the most recent case from this court, which summarized sort of all the earlier cases of this court, the focus there was on the discretionary judgment that that employee had in deciding which claims to pay and which claims not to pay, which, having made that factually based decision, was virtually unreviewable by his supervisor. There was no decision of Ms. Cruz that was virtually unreviewable by her supervisor, and in fact, all of the checks that she signed were reviewable by her supervisor and were reviewed ultimately by her supervisor as well as by the company accountant, less frequently by the company accountant than by her immediate supervisor, but nonetheless it was during that review process that ultimately she was determined to have engaged in this conduct.
Should we make a distinction between the bank teller who is in her first or his first few months of employment and one that's there for a significant period of time and earns some trust? Is there some implicit delegation of authority that can accrue over time, or would you say that violates the spirit of the guidelines?
I would say that it violates the spirit of the guidelines, and you should not draw a distinction between a new teller and a teller who's been there a long time. Now, there are cases in which someone becomes a senior teller, and usually that's a product of experience and having been there for a while, and that senior teller supervises other tellers.
I understand the person who earns a specific title, but I'm wondering whether the guidelines envision, if actually can be established, that a supervisor, in effect, creates a junior supervisor, if you will, in that there's an unwritten delegation that accrues over time to a long-term employee, and if it can be established, has, in effect, earned, so to speak, the right to have no supervision.
I suppose that at some point a teller might have the kinds of decisions imbued upon her by her supervisor or by her employer, in which you could conclude that that person exercised substantial discretionary judgment similar to a professional or a managerial person. I think the ordinary rule is no, and I think you ought not say that an ordinary bank teller who remains an ordinary bank teller by virtue of having been there a long time and having been...
She was the office manager. Now, who did she report to? Just the owner?
She reported to the owner, Kenneth Mason.
So was there anyone else above her?
No. Not within her sphere of responsibility. Now, originally, there was another individual who was above her. That person died.
So she's really the senior financial officer of the company under the owner.
Now that's a large leap, I think, Your Honor, to say that she's a senior financial person. I mean, obviously, she's not even authorized to sign checks. Now, I don't think that's true of a comptroller or a senior financial person. Every check she writes has got to be signed by Kenneth Mason. That's the way he designed it, and I think it shows that he didn't trust her fully. The prior person in the position was trusted fully, was a family member, and in fact did have the authority to sign checks. But he never entrusted Ms. Cruz with that.
But very often, I mean, even in our court, checks are co-signed by the chief judge and another judge. So does that mean neither of these people has a position of trust?
If you delegate responsibility,
that's the implication of your analysis.
It doesn't mean necessarily.
Co-signed checks, you know, means neither person is trusted.
It doesn't necessarily mean that the person
isn't
trusted.
Why would you require co-signing otherwise?
Because there has to be someone. I would think in the case of the court, there's a desire to have some uniformity. And
no, there isn't. It's the Congress distrusts officials and requires all sorts of co-signing of government checks.
Well, if you're asking me whether that necessarily implies a lack of trust, I think to some extent that it does. But that doesn't mean that in this particular case, or in all cases, it signifies that. Now, I think if the practice had been that previously this court...
But all you have going for you is that she didn't sign the checks.
Well, that's not all I have going for me at all, Your Honor.
You mean if she'd been allowed to sign the checks, she still wouldn't have occupied a position of trust? Because she was reviewed by the accountant?
I would think
that
it would
be an extreme position.
I think it would be a closer case, Your Honor, in the event that she wasn't allowed... If she was allowed to sign checks...
Well, why isn't this situation closer to that Hathcote case? Because there, the teller, there were similar controls on the teller, and the teller circumvented them by various means, like Cruz did here.
Yeah, and in that case, this court said that the decision that there was an abuse of trust should be reversed because I read that case as saying because the person who gave the authority was her supervisor, who herself was involved in wrongdoing, and therefore there wasn't abuse of a trust given by the bank. And because the bank didn't give her that discretionary judgment, it was the supervisor who gave the discretionary judgment. So I think this case is close to that. And I think, as I've argued, really what she is an ordinary bank teller.
Regarding your first point about how she didn't occupy a position of trust with respect to the bank, isn't that point knocked out by the relevant conduct provisions of the guidelines?
I don't think so, because in this case, the relevant conduct were all the instances of bank fraud that were committed by her, to which she only pled guilty to one execution for a small amount.
But she also defrauded her employer. She wasn't prosecuted for that, but that's relevant criminal conduct.
I would disagree with Your Honor's conclusion, because under the plea agreement, the relevant conduct were the other instances of bank fraud. That's what the government and I agreed to as part of our plea agreement, and that's the way they charged it. And so the reason she got a higher guideline was because we had agreed that there was $121,000 in bank fraud and not some lesser figure. That was the relevant conduct. And she's obviously, as I argue, not in a trusted relationship with any banks. Thank you.
Thank you, Shoback. Ms. Steiner?
Good morning. May it please the Court, Deborah Steiner on behalf of the United States. Mr. Shoback raises two arguments to this Court, beginning with the last one first, and that is whether or not Ms. Cruz was in a position of trust with the victim in this case. It's the government's position that this Court's decision in Bagavan, an IRS tax fraud case, settles the issue. And in that case, the defendant was charged with...
But isn't that a relevant conduct case?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, Mr. Shoback just said you can't argue relevant conduct because of the terms of the plea agreement.
Actually, Judge, under the U.S. sentencing guidelines, I believe that all relevant conduct is considered by the probation officer in the court when determining what the sentence of a particular individual will be.
But and you can have a plea agreement which excludes it, which can't you?
You could. The plea agreement in this case did not exclude it, and
What was he talking about then?
Well, in this plea agreement, I believe what Mr. Shoback was referring to, and it's not entirely clear to me, but Ms. Cruz pled guilty to one count of bank fraud in an information because she had cooperated with the government.
No, I understand that. What he said was that the plea agreement specified that the only relevant conduct consisted of other acts of fraud against the bank. And there was no relevant conduct consisting of defrauding her employer. Is that correct?
That's not correct. The plea agreement listed the amount of loss in this case at $121,000. That amount of loss was actually the loss sustained by PES in this case. There was no specific addressing of the source of relevant conduct in the plea agreement negotiated with the government.
What did the plea agreement speak to as regarding relevant conduct?
To my recollection, it didn't speak specifically to relevant conduct. It spoke to the bank fraud to which the defendant was pleading guilty and that the amount of loss was $121,000. And that, again, that amount of loss was a loss sustained by PES. The defendant next argues that even if PES could be considered a victim under relevant conduct in the sentencing guidelines, that she didn't hold a position of trust at PES. And on that issue, the government turns to two cases in this circuit, the Hernandez case and the Deal case. And I think both of those cases are
But how do you distinguish the bank teller? That's his principal argument. She didn't have any more authority than a bank teller.
I think you can distinguish a bank teller on a couple of fronts. In the first instance, with an ordinary bank teller who steals from the bank, that theft is uncovered in a relatively short period of time, and that is by balancing and determining the amount of money that is still present in the bank. In this case, by contrast, Ms. Cruz was able to conceal her theft from PES for nearly 2 years before anyone was able to discover that she had, in fact, embezzled from her employer. I think that distinguishes a situation where a bank teller who is under more rigorous supervision than Ms. Cruz was and is discovered in a relatively shorter period of time. And the Deal case, in fact, mentions the time duration and the ability to conceal the crime as two factors that cut in favor of finding an abuse of trust. The Hernandez and the Deal cases both involve individuals who worked for employers who had access and authority over valuable things. Ms. Cruz,
you said there were two distinctions between the bank teller and Cruz. You just mentioned one.
Oh, Judge, I was referring to the time it lasted and the ability to conceal
it. Those are the same point. That's one point. That's not two points.
Okay. I'd say that's the main distinction between an ordinary bank teller and Ms. Cruz's position.
Well, you wouldn't suggest, would you, Ms. Steiner, that a counter person at McDonald's or Burger King who could sustain a theft over a significant period of time would be different than one who's caught at the end of a week, would you? In other words, if you're in a situation where you have a lot of cash and there's a theft over a pronounced period of time as opposed to somehow the slippage being found or shortage being found in a week, would that somehow gain the enhancement?
Well, I think there are a number of factors that would need to be examined, and one of which would be the position that individual held. If that individual is a manager and supervising other individuals and able to conceal this in a way that person's supervisors couldn't discover it, possibly there could be an enhancement there. But if it's simply a person who is along the lines of an ordinary bank teller, who is a cashier at McDonald's who's able to cover it up for 2 weeks rather than 2 days, that's probably not an instance that would give rise to the enhancement in that case.
What about the laxity of supervision here? Does a company's lax supervision of an employee place that employee in a position of trust?
I think maybe not laxity of supervision, but maybe that was an acknowledgement of the trust that they placed in Ms. Cruz, understanding that she did have responsibility for the payroll and for the checks and for writing the checks and for paying the invoices that came in and presenting those to her supervisor for review. What could be characterized as laxity could also be characterized as trust given to that individual to follow through on her duties as expected of her rather than following through in a way that harms her employer.
So isn't the real difference from the bank teller that she's preparing documents? Is that what you're saying?
I think that's one distinction, Judge, but an ordinary bank teller would also prepare documents, I believe, at the end of the day in terms of reconciling their drawer. The difference with Ms. Cruz is that she not only prepared documents for the signature of another person, but then when those documents were returned to her, either from the bank in the way of canceled checks coming back from the bank, she destroyed those checks so that any audit that did come from her supervisors would cover any fraud that she committed. And she had the ability to control the amount of information that was given to her supervisors in order to make sure that she could continue to conceal her crime. And seeing no more questions, the government would request respectfully that this court affirm the district court's decision in this case.
Thank you, Senator. Ms. Shirley, your time has expired. You may have a minute. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chauvet. Thank you, Ms. Steiner. Thanks to all counsel.